Welcome to part two of Atlantic Stories, brought to you by Coastal Stories. I'm Charlie Connolly. We left Vincenzo Basti hidden away in his compartment in the Conte Grande, sailing across the Atlantic for New York. And Betty Simpson, the queen of the hobos, well, she'd just been sentenced to a month in prison in Winchester. And Clarence Terhune, the first ever aerial stowaway, was about to reveal himself as a stowaway on the Graf Zeppelin. If you haven't heard part one, it's probably best to go back and listen to that first. That was just a little recap. But here we go with part two of Atlantic Stories. The first crewman that Clarence saw when he emerged from among the postage sacks ignored him. The second nodded at him, assuming he was a passenger. But the third took him straight to Dr. Echener in the chart room. Echener asked him where he thought he was going. Clarence replied that he was rather hoping to go to Friedrichshafen. Echener wasn't exactly impressed to have a stowaway on board, but he wasn't hostile either. Clarence would be put to work in the galley, he said, and when he wasn't needed in the galley, he would clean the saloons from top to bottom. The passengers soon warmed to Clarence and told him he had some nerve. "I don't think I have any more nerve than the next boy," he replied, "but I guess wanderlust is more pronounced in my veins than in most folks." When Echener radioed New York and Friedrichshafen with news of the first ever aerial stowaway, it caused a sensation on both sides of the Atlantic. Reporters tracked down Clarence's sister Edith, who said, "The little devil. It's just like him. He's been doing things like this for a couple of years now, but this is the biggest job he ever undertook." In Germany, the Countess von Brandenburg Zeppelin, the daughter of the airship's inventor, offered to take care of Clarence when he arrived. There was an offer of work as an animal trainer at the Hagenbach Menagerie in Hamburg. A Berlin railway company offered him a job sitting in their information booth in Berlin, telling locals about the delights of America. There was even mention of a dozen marriage proposals awaiting his consideration when he arrived on the Zeppelin. In the meantime, Clarence was spending the three-day journey washing dishes and sweeping floors up there in the sky above the Atlantic Ocean. Betty had slept in worse places on her travels than Winchester Prison. It was warm, she was fed regularly. The women inmates were intrigued by her, and she got to tell all her stories to a brand new audience, and the 4 weeks passed relatively quickly. A little too quickly, if anything, because when the 4 weeks were up, she was being sent back to America. Newspapers across the country had got hold of the story of her imprisonment, including, she feared, the papers available in Galesburg, Illinois. And for Betty, that wouldn't necessarily be good news. The dining saloon had emptied. Vincenzo heard the engines power down, and there was a gentle thump of the Conte Grande nudging against the quayside on the Hudson River. All those years of dreaming, and hoping, and planning, and finally, here he was, a matter of feet from New York City. Manhattan. The future was just the other side of the steel plate next to him. He couldn't see America yet, but he was breathing American air. He filled his lungs, held his breath for a moment, then exhaled expansively. He was almost there. Vincenzo had a little longer to wait yet. His first thought had been to slide open the panelling when the saloon was empty, then leave the ship mingling with the rest of the passengers. But then there'd be immigration to pass through, and Vincenzo had no passport and no visa. However, he knew that while the Conte Grande was in port, it would be hosting a series of events and receptions before it returned to Europe, including, the following day, a lunch on board for an Italian society from Manhattan. If he waited for that, he could join the guests as they left, and nobody would be any the wiser. No passport checks, no visas. The liner hadn't been anywhere. So he could just walk down the gangway, disappear into the streets of New York, and start that new life he'd been planning for so long. Late in the evening of October the 31st, 72 hours after the Graf Zeppelin had left New Jersey, cannon fire and church bells rang out across Friedrichshafen as the airship eased towards its mooring, completing the first ever commercial return flight across the Atlantic. A crowd had gathered at the airfield, but mostly, it seemed, for a glimpse of Clarence Terhune, the world's first aerial stowaway. The American consul had gone aboard and suggested Clarence climb out of a rear window to escape the crowds, but when he did, a gaggle of girls was there to meet him. Eventually, he made it to the airfield offices, where he was questioned by police, only for his answers to be drowned out by the crowd hammering at the windows. The officials gave in, and Clarence spent half an hour signing autographs, before being fined $20 for entering the country illegally. He was invited to the Berlin Opera House by the renowned tenor Michael Bornen, and presented on stage during the interval to receive the biggest ovation of the night. Then he moved on to the American consulate at Stuttgart to obtain a passport, then took a train to Paris, travelled on to Le Havre, and set sail for home on the Ile de France. He wasn't sure what he'd do next, he said, but thought he was probably finished with caddying. He was, he told reporters asking about his family, an orphan. And in that word lay the secret that may have driven Clarence Terhune to make his great journey. Betty Simpson paused at the bottom of the gangplank before she boarded the Lancastria at Southampton, destined for New York. "It's been great fun," she beamed at the reporters. "If all England is as nice as an English prison, then it must be just fine. I've enjoyed myself very much." It was September the 8th, 1928, and she'd just stepped out of a police van from Winchester Prison to the quayside at Southampton Dock. She kept waving all the way up the gangway, but as soon as she was alone on board the ship, Betty switched off her smile. Once she disembarked at New York, there was only one place she could really go. Because Betty Simpson wasn't, as she'd claimed, a farmer's daughter from Brownsville, Texas, who'd been on the road for years and clocked up more than 60,000 miles in 48 American states, not to mention numerous ocean crossings. She wasn't necessarily out looking for her ideal man either, as she told those newspapers in San Francisco the previous year. Indeed, when she'd hopped aboard the Matsonia in 1927, she'd only recently left home, and that home was in Galesburg, Illinois, where she lived as Mrs. Della Elizabeth Brogan, a garment worker at the Galesburg Overall Company, married to George Brogan, a plumber. She had grown up as a farmer's daughter called Betty Simpson, all right, but a long way from Brownsville, Texas, as she'd claimed. Born in Bloomfield, Illinois, her family moved to Ada, Oklahoma, when Betty was 10. At 16, she went to live with relatives in Galesburg and took a job at a dry goods store where she met and fell in love with George Brogan. The teenagers skipped across the state line to Indiana and got married when they were both still 17. In 1926, Betty endured a period of ill health that kept her in bed for several weeks. George would bring home magazines to keep his wife occupied while he was at work, and it was there, alone for most of her waking hours in the bedroom of their bungalow,
that Betty became truly aware that there was life beyond that small town. Reading stories and seeing pictures from all over the world, suddenly small-town life with George in their modest bungalow spread out before Betty with a terrible inevitability. There had to be more than this. One day in 1926, George came home with a pile of new magazines to find Betty gone. A note on the table saying she was terribly sorry, but there was a wide world out there and she had to see as much of it as she could. "I may never return," she wrote, "or I may be back in a year." It had been more than a year, and Betty had become so famous now she couldn't really pretend anymore. Every time she pitched up in a new town, she told a new story. She could be whoever she wanted to be. But now, with her picture in newspapers across the country, the truth was rising near the surface. She would go back to Galesburg and back to George, to see if her adventures had sated her wanderlust, to see if she really was ready to go back to her marriage and back to the clothes factory, back to being Mrs. Della Brogan of Galesburg. That is, if George could still have her. "I've come back to George for good and forever," she said on her return to New York. "I've always loved George, and appreciate him more than ever now I've seen the world. And of all the places I've been, Galesburg is the nicest of them all." Describing her adventures, she said, "I could leave home tomorrow and travel all the way to Jerusalem without buying a ticket," before adding quickly, "I won't though. I'm going home to George, and that's where I'll stay." She told some reporters she was married. She told others that she was going back to marry her childhood sweetheart. Either way, the closer Betty got to Galesburg, the closer she came to revealing the truth of her situation. The excitement meant it had taken Vincenzo Basti a long time to get to sleep that last night. It was strange not being lulled by the throb of the engines too, but he drifted off eventually. When he woke up, switched on his lamp and looked at his watch, it was nearly 2 o'clock. He'd slept far later than he should have, but had woken just in time. The lunch would be finishing about now. He got dressed and sat down on his bed for a moment. He thought back to all those nights in Ortona, when he'd lain awake planning his escape to the promised land of America. And now, here he was. In a few minutes he'd be on the streets of Manhattan, and finally his life could start. He'd done it. He'd really done it. Vincenzo stood up, took one last look at his tiny cabin, put on his hat, slid back the panelling, and stepped into the empty saloon. All he had to do now was find those diners and slip in among them. Clarence Terhune was indeed an orphan when he'd boarded the Zeppelin, but he'd only been one for a matter of weeks. In July, his father, Charles Terhune, had murdered Clarence's mother, Janet, in the bedroom of their apartment on Francis Street in St. Louis, Missouri, then walked to the kitchen, poured himself a glass of wine, drank it, smoked a cigarette, and cut his own throat. He'd been in hospital since May, after Clarence's sister Edna had become concerned by Charles's increasingly unpredictable behaviour and worried for her mother's safety. He'd obtained a day pass from the hospital after claiming, falsely, a relative was seriously ill. Then he'd gone home, murdered his wife, and killed himself. Clarence was caddying in Westchester when he got the news. He'd felt more settled there than he had for a long time. He liked his work, he liked the people, he liked his lodgings. Mrs. Donnelly, his landlady, reminded him of his mother. He'd started to wonder whether he might even stay put there for a while. Then the telegram arrived. He couldn't go home. He couldn't face that. All he felt was a compulsion to get as far away as he could. He just had to work out where and how. Then Clarence heard about the Graf Zeppelin. When he returned to the US, things didn't really work out as Clarence hoped. He was dogged by rumours that his voyage was a publicity stunt, organised by the newspapers of William Randolph Hearst. As a minor, he'd granted his sister power of attorney to negotiate selling interviews and booking lucrative appearances on the vaudeville stage, but she'd been ripped off by an unscrupulous agent and lost everything. By February 1930, not much more than a year after his epic voyage, Clarence was back in St. Louis, operating a slideshow of his adventure in a small tent in a distant corner of the city's aircraft exposition. He became a prize fighter for a while, before in 1932 setting off on a round-the-world hitchhiking tour. He made it across the Pacific to Shanghai, but a febrile political atmosphere sent him back to San Francisco, and from there he meandered back to St. Louis. There he took a job with the city parks department, married in 1934, and lived quietly until his death in 1987 at the age of 79. Betty Simpson vanishes from the records after her return to Galesburg. She wasn't there in 1930, and on the 1940 census, George Brogan was describing himself as single. He married again and died in Galesburg in 1973, but Betty disappeared among the wispy caverns of time. We can only really speculate about what triggered Betty's travels. Maybe the illness that had confined her to bed for so long was severe depression. Maybe once the gloss of teenage romance had mottled, Betty found marriage to George stifling. Conventional life in small-town America smothering any ambition she may have had for herself. Maybe this was a genuine escape from a dead and loveless marriage. After all, had she told those San Francisco reporters that the man of her dreams had to prove that he can love me more than anyone else in the world? But any explanation of why Betty took off on her travels and what became of her afterwards is destined to be speculation. Maybe she spent the rest of her life on the move. Maybe she settled down somewhere under a new name with a man who'd proved to her what she needed him to prove. Maybe she finally found the happiness for which she'd set out to search the world, confining her adventures to a scrapbook of yellowing press cuttings hidden away in the attic. Somewhere there must still be those postcards she sold of Betty Simpson all around the world. Vincenzo Basti couldn't find the lunches. He tried all the saloons, but there was no sign of the Italian society, or indeed anybody. Then he turned a corner and almost walked into one of the ship's officers. The man, startled, asked who he was and what on earth he was doing there. Thinking quickly, Vincenzo said he was with the Italian society lunch, had gone to find a bathroom and got lost, and if the officer could show him back to where everyone else was gathered, he'd be very grateful. At this, the officer just looked even more baffled. After years of planning, after carrying out his remarkable plan to reach America, having made it right to the Manhattan quayside, Vincenzo Basti had made one tiny but crucial oversight. He'd forgotten to wind his watch. And while he was asleep, his watch had stopped. He hadn't woken at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. The members and guests of the Italian Society of Manhattan were not due on board for another 3 hours. Vincenzo finally left the ship he'd helped to build and made landfall in America, but it was in handcuffs. He was taken by a police launch to Ellis Island, and from there he was deported back to Italy. He never made it back to America, but I bet he kept his watch carefully wound for the rest of his life. The stories of Clarence, Betty and Vincenzo are Atlantic stories, brought to you by the Coastal Stories podcast. I'm Charlie Connolly. The new series of Coastal Stories will be back next month. I've got plenty of great tales lined up for you, so be sure to subscribe wherever you find your podcasts, if you're not among the hordes of splendid people around the world who subscribe already. Coastal Stories is on Facebook if you search for Coastal Stories Podcast, and you can find me on Twitter at Charlie Connolly. Please leave a review and a rating, particularly if you're listening on Apple Podcasts. It does help to spread the word. I hope you've enjoyed this Atlantic Stowaway special, and Coastal Stories will be back with a new series before you know it. But wait, I hear you cry. What about Johannes Thurnig, the German kid who'd posted himself across the Atlantic and would have made it but for some rough handling on the Hudson River quayside? Like Vincenzo, he too was led away in handcuffs to Ellis Island to be deported for entering the country illegally. But his story made the papers, with photographs of him in his crate. And people thought Johannes Thurnig was, well, the guy. Surely, they said, a person showing that amount of determination and ingenuity would be an asset to the United States. And after all, his actual papers were all in order. The fact his name wasn't on the passenger manifest was just a bit of a technicality. If you have a passport and a visa, can you really be entering the country illegally? A state senator took up his case. The famous Austrian opera singer Fritzi Schaeff offered to take him under her wing, and a community organisation paid the $70 it would have cost Johann to travel as a passenger, as well as the outstanding $21 cost of handling the crate. The immigration commissioners relented, and Johann was allowed to stay in America. He anglicised his name to John, sent for and married his fiancée Lottie, and by 1935, Johann Thurnig was president of a lithography company and had become a naturalised US citizen. Johannes was one of the lucky ones, one of the few stowaways whose illicit journey produced a happy ending. Every sea in the world is crisscrossed with stories of hopes and dreams, of trauma and escape, of adventure and heroism, of desperation and dashed expectations. The Atlantic, with its stories, more than most, is a repository of secrets.